Looking Forward Our Way podcast addresses today's critical issues affecting adults in Ohio. We focus on issues that affect our money and our neighborhoods. Our expert guests are here to provide the information and resources needed to address those challenges. We are looking forward our way. Hi, this is Brett. Many of us have taken on the role of caregiver for parents or other family members. Today, we're going to focus on the care issues for terminally ill patients and what resources do exist. Today's guest experts are Molly McMahon-Graziano, Director of Outreach for Ohio End of Life Options, and Kathleen Carmody, owner of Senior Matters Home Health Care and Consulting, a certified death doula and certified dementia practitioner. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us. Yeah.
Thank you so much for being with us today. Kathleen, that title of yours gets longer every time I see you.
You got one more thing. Lifelong learner.
Exactly. You know, that's, oh, good. So am I. So thank you again for both of you for being with us today. But before we actually plunge into this topic, we want to hear more about you. Now, Kathleen, you've been with us on a podcast in the past. We had a great time when you were with us before. Let's remind our audience about your journey, your career path, how you got to the point of owning your own healthcare organization, and now all this additional training you've been taking. And then when you're done, we'll have Molly give us her background and what brought her to Ohio End of Life Options.
Wonderful. Again, thanks for having us. I've worked with the elderly for all of my career. Started very early with Parks and Recreation in Columbus, and then got into work in nursing homes from marketing, admin, sales, activities director, things like that, and then kind of branched out from there into home health care. And I was doing sales for home health care. And I realized kind of in the middle of that journey that a lot of times when I would have met a client, a potential client, and I would bring that information back to our office, I would hear from the company owner or corporate that that job, wasn't big enough. It was the hours weren't enough.
The client needs.
The client needs weren't enough. And in home health care, a 24/7 client is what we all want. That's how it works. But over the years, the average of what people need is really 2 to 4 hours per day to help them stay in their home. So I was hearing a lot of no's, we can't help that person, or we're choosing not to take on that client. And it was kind of heartbreaking for me because there were some cases where people really did need help, but these companies weren't going to do it. So I actually striked out on my own and started Senior Matters Home Health Care. I had had years of experience in the field and not a business background, which kind of could have been a positive or a negative, but I sounds kind of cheesy, but I worked from my heart. And then that led to building a great team of caregivers that really do care. And we could do things that other companies weren't doing and help keep people at home. And then since then, I have been certified as an end-of-life doula. And that is another journey that kind of ties in very closely with home healthcare. We're in the homes with these clients, and if we're doing a really good job, we're with them till the very end of their life. So we develop that relationship with them, and it almost comes naturally. A lot of times, a doula is in that home holding the hand of that person till they take their last breath. So a doula brings a whole new arena to home healthcare space in conjunction with hospice.
Well, and when you were with us before, our specific topic was looking at home health care in the middle of the pandemic.
Yes.
And all of the crazy things that you had to do to pull it together so that the providers could still go and visit the patients and take care of people, or else these folks were home alone and trying to take care of themselves, which for many is nearly impossible. I've been there, done that. Actually had 24/7 caregivers, and it was quite a interesting adventure.
Absolutely.
But we survived it. So, yeah, kudos to your team. They've done a great job. And
thank you.
And,
thank you. They're very dedicated.
We've heard lots of good things about them. So thank you. So the training that you've done on the death doula, how is that? And this, you're also a certified dementia practitioner. Mm-hmm. How is that the same or different?
It does overlap. Obviously, with our demographic of elderly, a lot of our clients do have dementia, right, and they can be terminal. And that can be, that has a whole host of issues with it, especially as we get towards end of life. If someone has advanced Alzheimer's, they can't tell you where they hurt or how they hurt. We have to learn how to anticipate that. So I'm for me, and how we've structured our doula work is that those two really work together. Now, if we're with a younger person that's terminal, that, you know, that's not necessary. But they really do come together and complement one another in our demographic of aged.
Great. Thank you. Molly, let's hear about you. You're new to this podcast.
I am new and very, very glad to be here. Thank you for having me. I have spent my entire career in the nonprofit sector. I've worked in hunger insecurity and organ and tissue donation and recovery. And but probably the tipping point as far as really having an impact in my end of life work was I was the primary caregiver for both of my parents in the early 2000s. My dad was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer at the same time my mom was living with COPD. There was five siblings, but only one lived close to my parents. So I had to kind of, it was baptism by fire. I had to jump in. I was only in my 30s, so it was pretty isolating, a kind of a lonely experience, and there weren't really nearly the resources that there are today. So I learned a lot. It was an amazing experience. It was hard. It was sad, but I'm so grateful that I had that time with them. Their image of how they wanted to die with dignity actually looked that they wanted to die at home. They wanted to have their faith involved in their end-of-life care, and they wanted to make sure that their pain was controlled. Mm-hmm. And I feel very proud that we were able to make that happen for them. And so after that, I had the opportunity to meet Lisa Vigil Schattinger, who is our executive director, just by happenstance. And Lisa's story is very compelling. She grew up in Oregon, and when her stepdad was diagnosed with cancer, he opted to use Oregon's death with dignity law. He was a retired neurologist. He had seen a lot of things, obviously working in healthcare all of his life, and decided he knew what he wanted the end of his life to look like. So Lisa, who is a nurse by training, and then her mom, who is also a nurse by training, walked through that experience with him as well as his children. And when she came back to Ohio, she started sharing what that experience was like, because obviously it was, you know, it's quite a unique experience to have. And people kept saying to her, well, why don't we have something like that in Ohio? Why don't we have something like that in Ohio? And so she never intended to start a nonprofit organization, but she got enough feedback that people really wanted to have the option to at least start working on it. So she founded Ohio End of Life Options, and then she and I have been partnering ever since to just kind of grow this small grassroots organization.
You know, it happens so often that nonprofits or social service agencies come about because of a personal experience. Mm-hmm. Brett's been through caregiving for parents. I took care of my dad. After my mom died very suddenly, she had been his caregiver for years. So then suddenly I was, and you had to take off work and, you know, all those kinds of things happening. But that's how I got into senior services, from having been in higher ed for 30 years. So It is amazing how that comes about and how that it's easy to be dedicated when it's something that's really touched your heart.
Very much so. Very much so. And we find a lot of people that come to our issue have had similar experiences. And same thing with the death doulas. The death doulas are walking, you know, beside people at the very end of their life. So we find that death doulas were one of the original groups to say, hey, we're really supportive of what you're doing. We absolutely, because they're really working so hard every day to try to honor the wishes of their patients. Mm-hmm. And so it was just kind of a natural fit. And we've had the opportunity to visit and, well, not even visit, but necessarily go and attend different conferences in Ohio. And the response has been overwhelmingly positive, especially people that work in the end of life space. Mm-hmm. Recognize that there needs to be as many options as possible because everybody has a unique way of imaging or, you know, kind of getting an idea of what they want their end of their life to look like. And they might not have any control over the disease, but they would like to know what all of their options are as far as end of life goes.
Yeah. Well, Kathleen, I want to go back to what you talked just a minute ago. I mean, can you give us details on this, the new role of the death doula, how it emerged and how is it different than a hospice team? Because you brought that up just briefly. I think that needs to be unfolded a little bit more because I think we're all familiar with hospice. We know the term, but how they differ, basically.
Sure. I realized that we were doing end-of-life work without being doulas. We were with our clients at the last moments. Mm-hmm. We called the funeral homes. We sat with the grieving spouse. We helped the children walk through all that. So then I had the opportunity to train with Dr. Martha Jo Adkins, who just is a phenomenal teacher. And I wanted to bring doula more to the forefront of what we do because it is a separate issue from home care. But and if you're in the home care space, I strongly feel it just goes together. As I said earlier, if you're with a client till the very end, I mean, 5, 6, 7 years, you know, you're likely going to be with them till the very end. So what could we learn more about end of life? You know, all of the different stages, all of the rituals, all of those things that encompass end of life from practical matters, you know, wills, estate planning, all of that to the physical, to the emotional. So that kind of took its own space and comes together very nicely for us. Where that differs from hospice is hospice in general, I think the average time someone's on hospice is about 2 weeks. That may be growing a little more now over the years, but normally it was 2 weeks, and that's because hospice is still such a frightening word. Mm-hmm. So we are with the client for the duration. And again, we may have had this relationship for a number of years. Hospice comes in at the very end of life, towards the end of life, obviously. Hospice is you have to have 9 months expectancy of life. You can certainly be recertified. We've had a lot of clients graduate from hospice, which is wonderful.
Yeah.
So hospice comes in towards the end, manages all the medication and pain management. So that's the main thing that hospice does, although they do obviously more than that. They provide volunteers, chaplains, all of those other things that hospice does. Hospice is mainly the medical end of it, where doula is we're there around the clock. At those end of day times, as things are coming nearer to an end. So we're watching the changes. We're watching the breathing. We're watching the medications, things like that. Hospice cannot be there 24/7, so we fill that void in conjunction.
Good. I Nat explained it very well. Good. I was figuring that was where it was going, but if you've never gone through a hospice situation, okay, I get what hospice is, but I've never experienced it.
Absolutely.
You know, sort of thing, yeah.
And I don't think hospice is ever what you think it's going to be either. Yeah. A lot of folks think hospice is 24/7 care.
They do.
Over a long period of time, and you find out real quickly that's not it. And they literally are just kind of jumping in and out.
Yes.
That's the experience I had. I probably am the only person in Franklin County who actually complained about hospice. It's a long story, but it was a situation, and this kind of goes with my next question to you. You know, you have to meet the family needs. It's not just the individual. Hospice would come in to see my dad during the day, and we had an array of caregivers. None of them had all the information on my dad. And so when hospice would come in, it was the nurse, the social worker, you know, the PT or whatever, whoever they were sending, they were getting, I don't want to say false information, but only part of the story. And I kept saying, and my dad graduated from hospice. I was so relieved. because at that point it was 6 months and he was doing fine. So they took him off, but then the doctor wanted him to come back. And I'm like, I don't want hospice because unless they are there when I'm there, it does no, it does none of us any good. They have to hear from me or at least call me on the phone. Finally, they had to hire somebody to be a case manager at night to take care of our case. They'd never done that before. So that's my question to you. A death doula is not just about the individual. There are all kinds of things happening. Tell us about that, those relationships, those stages you're going through with the family members, like you said, wills and funeral homes and all of those kinds of things that if somebody's not had a death in the family, they have no clue.
That's a great point. Everything you said was so pertinent, but if you've not had a death in the family, in your home, hospital is a completely different story, but in your home, you do not know what to expect. So just one example, we had a client that was just, we were doing home care and then they moved to hospice. So we would do round the clock shifts. And so we upped our schedule, but I made sure that the wife went out for a walk. She went to go visit the grandchildren. We instinctively would take the trash out, throw in a load of laundry. Those practical things that if you are caring for a loved one, don't get done, nor do you care about it that time. But those things for, you know, an exhausted spouse to go to bed with clean sheets, things like that. The very, very practical up to the, can I get you a cup of coffee while she's sitting there just beside herself, not knowing, you know, how long her husband's going to live and the sadness and the emotion that come with all of that. You know, we do this on a daily basis, but it is your client's very first time losing a loved one in that situation that you're involved with. So that can never be taken for granted. And I think that as a doula, we have that time with the client. We have clients that we work with well ahead of even being on hospice that want to leave a legacy. They want weekly meetings. They want to plan exactly their rituals. They want to say, I want my bed facing the window here, you know, really very involved. I've seen that change over the years, and I feel that certain personalities are more prone to that kind of planning than, for example, we had a Marine not too long ago, into his 90s. He, you know, I wouldn't even bring up talking to him about certain things like that because his personality was just extremely different. Some people are very receptive. Others don't want that. Doula can be very touchy-feely, if you will. But also, we're very, very practical. So we cover a lot of ground there with hospice. And we're, you know, we've already have that relationship with the family usually. And, you know, very often we still have the relationship with hospice and know who the nurses are coming in.
Right. Mm-hmm. I think that my mom and I were prepared because my dad had been sick for so many years. So then when she passed, I was a little more prepared and also never heard never got an answer that I didn't keep asking the question until I got the answer I wanted, basically. But with the care, we were very lucky with a group of caregivers long before doulas probably were thought of who were attuned to family needs and often would just sit down with me and say, okay, we got to prepare for this, we got to prepare for that. So that's really, you know, if people have not had a death in the family in the house or long-term illness, it's a gauntlet to run. It is just terrible. I mean, it's not easy in the medical community if you're not part of it.
Absolutely. I remember when our mom died many years ago, we were alone. We didn't have hospice there. They were gone. So it was just my big Irish family, all of us. But we waited. The priest was with us and the funeral director came in, took my mom from upstairs, and then the priest took us all in the kitchen and just said, you all stay here for right now. And then they took her out. That, you know, again, we keep saying this, but you just, you think you can be prepared, but until you actually go through it, you don't know exactly how you feel, how you're going to react. It's very, very difficult. And to have someone there in the background, I think that's also very important. We're not telling people what to do. We're not directing. We may be directing from the background, but very respectfully guiding and then getting the family to where they need to be. I remember one client, her husband died. We were with him, and we packed her up to go to the son's house. She said, I can't stay here, and I already knew we were going to take her to the son's. So we got some of her things together in a little suitcase for her, got her everything she needed for several days, packed her up, put her in the car, and took her over to the son's. So it's not just like you're there for the duration.
Mm-hmm. All right.
And I love, too, that death doulas all have certain specialties. So you really, it's so individual. You might interview 3 to 5 death doulas just to find the right match for you, because they do, everybody brings something different. They're not clinical.
Right.
They might, I know a couple of death doulas who are trained nurses, but they do not do anything clinical. So they can have that time. And hospice nurses that are coming out and doing calls, they're on a time crunch. They have to see all these patients in the day. Your death doula can stay there. They can be that point person. You can find the person that you match with and that matches with your family and what you're looking for in that, too. So I think it's wonderful that we have so many death doulas that have all kinds of different specialties, and it's really about finding the one that works for the patient.
Right, because every case is different.
Absolutely.
Every patient needs are different. Family needs are different. Mm-hmm. And it's...
It's the continuity of care as well.
Right. Very much so.
Like you said
so
with your dad.
Is there like a registry for death doulas? I mean, if somebody is listening to this podcast in Timbuktu, Iowa,
yeah.
I guess, they can.
There actually is.
Okay.
There's many different organizations, but there is a, I can't remember the name of it right now, but a registry.
Yeah. Okay.
And then a lot of times within your doula organization, social media, we'll see, is there a doula available in New York City, I saw last week, or a doula available here.
Okay.
So it's kind of a, you know, we help one another. You know, it's not like there's companies out there specifically, doulas are us, for lack of better words. So you're an individual person with those skills. You know, I happen to have the home healthcare company that goes along with it, but a lot of times there may be someone that has social worker background might be a doula. Mm-hmm. So there are definitely ways to communicate.
Okay. So audience, we'll have a list of resources with this posting of this podcast, and Kathleen's going to give me all the tips and hints on how to find a death doula in your neighborhood.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Well, Mala, let's get back to you. Give us an overview of the mission and vision of Ohio End of Life Options. You know, tell us about the organization and how you're supporting Ohioans.
Sure. So we have a 501c3, which is our kind of information and awareness nonprofit. And then we have a 501c4, which is our political fund that allows us to do lobbying and do things at the state house. Right now, our 501c4 is open and available. We're not doing a lot of work at the state house right now, because right now we're really focused, because we are a small grassroots, and really building our coalition of support across the state. You know, we live in a state of 11 million people. And as I always say, when we do finally get down to the state house, we want to walk through those doors with thousands, not hundreds. So I travel across the state. I do a lot of public speaking. I educate people. I kind of give them my philosophy generally, and I did this a lot with my organ and tissue donation work, was to really make the process as transparent as possible. Let people ask questions that they've always kind of wondered about, but they didn't quite know how to ask it or where to ask it or where to get that answer. Unfortunately, there is a lot of misinformation out there about medical aid in dying. And one of my goals is to just say, ask me anything you want, or let me give you this information, because I really feel like everyone should have a fully informed consent or fully informed opportunity to know what medical aid in dying is, what it is not, too, because we have the strictest laws in the world. The U.S. has the strictest laws in the world. What is the eligibility? What are the criteria? And for people, if you live in a state that has medical aid in dying, you know, there are state organizations that can help patients navigate the process. And if you live in a state without medical aid in dying, you can travel to some certain states and be able to access medical aid in dying. So we try to make sure that people at least know where to look. And like we were talking about the death doulas in the registry, one of the things that we're doing with our organization is trying to create a directory. So in Ohio, at least, you would be able to know by region who your death doulas are. And we're trying to make sure that we integrate that into our website, because we are so, so, so supportive of the work that death doulas are doing. Hospice is doing amazing work. Again, I've had that familiar experience with that. A lot of times people don't realize, they'll call us. As I said before, we don't do a lot of direct service, but people will call us and ask us questions. And you'd be surprised how many people don't realize that they can be going through chemo, radiation, and being able to access palliative care at the same time. People think palliative care is only a hospice thing, and it's not. So we try to educate people, because we want everyone to have as good a death as possible. And that's going to look different to a bunch of different people. Kathleen and I have spoken about this before, but it's a lot like when you're looking at the birth process. You know, some women are like, bring that epidural on.
To my mind,
right?
Well,
bring that epidural on. Others are like, absolutely, I don't want any medication. And so it's such a deeply, deeply personal experience. And we want to make sure that people have the tools that they need and that they're hopefully having these kinds of conversations before they are in a crisis situation. The best time to talk about your end of life planning is when you don't need to.
Yeah.
So we just we do a lot of work and try to encourage people to get their advanced directives. How to pick a healthcare proxy or healthcare power of attorney, because they happen to be your oldest child doesn't necessarily mean they're the best person to be your healthcare power of attorney, and what to look for in those people. Because having walked in those shoes and known and seen things and experienced and observed things, you can tell when families have had end-of-life conversations, and then you can tell when it's just there's been zero dialogue and nobody knows what anybody wants. And it's really so, so hard on the families. And it ends up then in turn being hard on the patients, because sometimes, you know, we're just keeping them on the ventilator longer than they should be on the ventilator. We're not allowing them to, you know, have a DNR and things like that. So really the best time to have any kind of end-of-life conversation is, you know, as soon as you turn 18, you should be starting to have end-of-life conversations.
Well, and lawyers are doing, I think, a better job when you're updating your will at any age, mm-hmm. of going through all of that medical power of attorney.
Yes.
And now there's a survey, at least I just filled one out a few years ago, on do you want this, do you want that, do you want to donate organs, do you,
yes.
you know, and which ones, and to the nth detail. So it seems that the legal community has tried to fill in a little bit of that gap.
Yes.
But there are still a lot of gaps out there. And
there.
It seems like the family members, as you said, it's just not something people want to talk about.
Mm-hmm. No.
If a family calls you, and they're waiting, you know, have a terminally ill patient in the home, what are you telling them? How are you getting them to the point of being able to talk about this?
Well, Lisa Vigil Schattinger, our executive director, being a nurse, she usually will field those phone calls for us. The first thing we're going to encourage them to do is to go back and have a conversation with their healthcare team. If they are in an ICU or they're in a hospital setting and they're really, really worried about how things are going, and they, like, maybe there's a few family members who want to have an end-of-life conversation, but they know they're going to run up against people who are just not ready, we will suggest maybe that they get a palliative care consult. Because at the end of the day, the palliative care team in the hospital generally has some more time. They have specialized training in how to facilitate goals of care conversations. They're able to deal with the complex family dynamics that you can have in place when you're looking at end-of-life conversations, that often the ICU nurses and the ICU social workers don't always have the time to sit down and do that. So in my personal life, if somebody asks, I will usually say get a palliative care consult. I will either then, if not, then I will definitely ask them to see if they can talk with a social worker, social workers always tend to have that a 30,000 foot perspective and be able to kind of know and refer and at least get you the information that you need. But that's usually like if they're calling in a crisis, because as I said, we don't consult and we don't provide legal or medical advice. So we always want to encourage them to go back to their team. And oftentimes the phone calls that we get are just that there's one side of the family that is in this camp, one side of the family that's in the other camp. And I think the folks that, in my experience, even the people that are reluctant to, you know, let their loved one go, there's a reason behind that. And palliative care teams and social workers and death doulas can do an excellent job of being able to help flush out those conversations, because usually, you know, it's based in fear. There might be some complex family dynamics that, you know, came from childhood, whatever the case may be. And you want the end of life experience to, of course, be good for the patient. But when I used to do a lot of training for the doctors, I used to say to them, and Kathleen kind of referred to this earlier, is that they're only going to be told one time that their loved one is brain dead, and you're going to be the person that's going to do it. You are literally going to be part of that person's end of life story for the rest of the family's life.
Mm-hmm.
And being able to train and to know how to do that compassionately, yet informatively, palliative care people, just the palliative care teams in hospitals, if you have one, can really just be such a wonderful, wonderful resource.
And that's the kind of information, though, that you or Lisa are able to provide a client in Ohio specifically to a palliative care?
We will usually, if they're calling from a hospital setting, we'll say, talk to your nurse or your doctor about getting a palliative care consult, or just request one.
Yeah. You had mentioned that there are some states who have legal recourse, that it's possible for an individual to make this choice.
Yes.
For themselves.
Yes.
Ohio is not one.
Correct.
Can you give us a little overview of,
sure,
of what's out there?
Sure. So probably the most popular state that everyone pretty much knows about is Oregon. Oregon was the original. They have their death with dignity law. And then let's see if I can remember all off the top of my head. Let me see if I can. Washington, California, Hawaii, Colorado, New Mexico, Vermont, Maine, Delaware just passed a law this year. New York has passed a law. It has not been signed by the governor yet. So we're thrilled to have two states being able to pass legislation. And on average, about 20 states per year put forth legislation. And sometimes you put forth the legislation, not that you think it's going to go all the way through the House and the Senate and get signed, but you're starting conversations. So our policy team spends time at the State House doing a lot of education about what medical aid in dying is, what it's not, what the eligibility criteria is, and really focusing on what the American model looks like. I'd say one of the biggest obstacles that I have to overcome, because I do a lot of the public speaking, I do a lot of our social media, so I'm always having conversations online with people, is everyone lumping together Canada, the Netherlands, Belgium, and the United States. Our laws are nothing like theirs. But it's very tricky, obviously, especially online, to have a conversation, because you might be having a conversation with people from 10 different mm-hmm. countries. So we really want the folks in the United States to understand what our model and what our framework looks like, and how they can access it. So two states do not have residency requirements. Most of the legislation that's ever been written since the beginning does require you to be a resident of that state. That's shifting a little bit. So what's happened now is Oregon and Vermont both will allow people to come to their state. They have to go through the entire process, the entire eligibility process, the ingestion process, everything in the state. But you can go and access medical aid in dying in those states, which sounds like, oh, okay, well, I live in Ohio and we don't have a law. I'll just go to Vermont. You know, number one, you're terminally ill. You're not going to be physically as well as, you know, you're going to feel bad. Logistically, it can be a challenge. You still have to have two separate physicians in that particular state certify that you are terminally ill and have a life expectancy of less than 6 months. You have to have multiple requests. There has to be generally waiting periods through the requests, or you have to have been enrolled in hospice to waive the waiting periods. So it takes, they usually recommend, Vermont and Oregon will generally recommend that you're in their state for about 30 days to go through the entire process. Mm-hmm. So that's not really an option for everyone. And I think one of the things that I just feel unfortunate that our folks don't have access to this is because dying well in a way that reflects your values and belief shouldn't be dependent on your zip code.
And your bank account.
And your bank account. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Exactly. Because the U.S. Supreme Court determined that medical aid in dying is a states' rights issue. So it's not going to ever be a federal, it's not going to be ever at the federal level. We'll always be passing it state by state, which is fine because I think every state has kind of their own little personality. We're thrilled because we did a survey in 2018 and we found that about 7 in 10 Ohioans support the option, even if it's not one that they would use. Gallup did a survey that showed about 74% of Americans support at least having access to the option. And so when we're talking to most people, once we make them aware that we're kind of working on this, they're like, oh, good, this is what I want. I want this option because either they're living with a terminal illness themselves, they've lost someone that they love to a terminal illness, and even if they did have, like I would consider my parents to have had a good death as defined by them. And it's really how everybody kind of defines what that end of life experience looks like for them. So our hope is to eventually be able to pass legislation in Ohio that will allow this option for terminally ill patients.
In all of the articles and things that I was reading for this podcast, the one thing I was really, I don't want to say happy, but really right. pleased to see was how much information is put into the legislation that protects the individual.
Yes.
This isn't just, oh, you know, my child who is going to inherit a lot of money is decided,
right.
kind of thing. You know, it people are yes. really taken care of.
They absolutely are. And we have, you know, a lot of years of collective data to show that the laws do work as intended, the safeguards work as intended, and there's zero verified cases of abuse or coercion. Because the picture of someone who's considering medical aid in dying is someone who, just go ahead and maybe just use myself as an example. So say I'm diagnosed with a cancer. Of course, I want to live as long and as well as I can. So in doing that, I'm going to get my chemo, my radiation, you know, obviously depending on what kind of cancer I have. I'm going to go through all of that. There's a, you know, we are human beings and our instinct is to survive. But if that time comes and, you know, a few years down the line or whenever that time comes and the doctors say we've exhausted all the treatment options that you have now, I want to get on hospice. I think a really neat thing about states that have aid in dying is that anecdotally, and we haven't done any official research on this, but anecdotally, they tend to have earlier hospice enrollment in states that have aid in dying because terminally ill patients might be coming and saying, hey, you know, the doctors have said they can do everything they can do. The other thing I like about the legislation in the U.S. is that all of that legislation requires the physician to give them information about all of their end of life options. So then they usually go into hospice. In Oregon, over 90% of the people that use aid in dying are enrolled in hospice. And I feel fairly comfortable saying in most states, it's probably between 70 and 80% of the people that use aid in dying are enrolled in hospice. So they live well on hospice. And maybe they graduate or whatever the case may be, generally not with our specific population. But then they have that hospice. And then should their suffering become too much, as defined by them, then in states with aid in dying, they have the option to have that peaceful, controlled, planned death.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. Well, it's good to hear that, you know, your organization partners and assists the patients and their families. You gave a great example of, you know, walking through and such. Are there other organizations that we should be familiar with?
Yeah. So there are two national advocacy organizations. There is Compassion and Choices and Death with Dignity National Center. So those are the two national advocacy organizations. There's also now a national clinical organization called the Academy for Aid in Dying Medicine. And they are really doing wonderful work because they are really starting to create the infrastructure for this medical subspecialty of aid in dying medicine. And so they're doing a lot of research. There's physicians that are participating in, you know, reporting, you know, different pharmaceutical protocols for patients, depending on what kind of illness they have and how long is it, you know, is it effective? Is the patient comfortable? And all of those kinds of things. So those in the United States are the two advocacy organizations and then the Academy of Aid in Dying Medicine.
One of the things that we always ask our guests to do is to give us their last words of wisdom. And I'm going to have Molly start. Just give us an idea of how you would suggest a listener work through this for themselves, to think through for themselves or a family member to get on the right path.
I like to say that I think adults know more what they want at the end of their life than they actually think they do. I think if you really think about how you've lived your life and the things that are important to you and what your priorities are and what your values are, and that's the first thing. So I think the thing that keeps people really in the dark is that they don't think they know. They don't know exactly how all the intricate paperwork works for everything. So it's kind of overwhelming, and then nobody starts anything. So the first thing to do is, I will always tell people, if you have family members that you can't get to talk, turn on a movie, a documentary that specifically has an end-of-life topic, and start a conversation. Sometimes it's easier for people to talk about an objective television show than it is for them to talk about what their own needs are. But that's an opportunity for them to start really kind of evaluating. There's really wonderful documentaries and great books out there, at least about our specific topic, but also about end of life. I think Finish Strong is a really great book that Barbara Combs Lee wrote. I've had a few senior groups use those and then bring us in to kind of talk about how that helped them out and help that help them planning. Because a lot of this really is very value-based. You're going to tick off the boxes for the paperwork. But the other surprising thing I see is you've got to tell your family. Mm-hmm. I did a presentation with a senior group, and there was probably 35 people in there, and bless their hearts, everybody had their paperwork done. And I said, and how many of you have sat down with your children and reviewed what's in the paperwork? There's a lot less hands. Your children or your caregivers or whoever that is need to hear it verbally from you. You don't have to talk about it every day, all day, but you do have to have that conversation, because when the time comes that they need to honor your wishes, all those things will start to flood back. And they'll know what your philosophy, what your end-of-life philosophy is, and be able to meet your needs and give you what you want at the end of your life.
Wonderful. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Kathleen, last words of wisdom.
There's just so much involved in it, but I would say that I think it's a great idea for families to look ahead, develop a relationship with, I do a lot of consulting, not just in home care, but that type of thing. So you know, let's say your parents are getting older and you know there might be a diagnosis coming up. Get that ball rolling with how you're going to provide care in the home while they want to stay home, or if they want to go to a facility, start looking at facilities. Know how to find a good facility. Look at the Medicare sites and the ratings and all of that, because the closest facility to your home may not be the best. So there's just so much to do that, you know, once the shock of a diagnosis sets in, you really need to get moving on pulling all of those things together, from the practical paperwork to finding out what your loved one wants, and also supporting that loved one, supporting their needs. I always find that it's not the client or the patient. They know what they want. They want medical aid in dying. They want this. They want to stop treatment or whatever the case may be. It's the loved ones that might not really understand that. And there is a series of documentaries called Take Me Out Feet First, which is absolutely wonderful, kind of encompasses all of this that we're talking about. And I remember the first time I watched it with Dr. Adkins, I was on pins and needles, but it was a beautiful, beautiful story about how this particular documentary of this one documentary, how the family planned it, and how the adult children and grandchildren finally accepted it. And, I say we can't choose how we come in the world, but we may be able to kind of plan how we go out. And I think that is just so important. Another tool I use is just extremely practical. It's called the NOKE box, next of kin. I order them for all my clients. It's a box. It's like a file box. It has every single thing you need in there. If mom and dad live in Florida and they have keys for their bike lock, there's a spot in there for that, all the way up to the attorney, to absolutely covers everything. That is a good way to get started on something that is not so daunting and frightening. So I think just developing a relationship with somebody in the community that knows what you may be facing and how to look at it.
Sounds good. Yeah.
Thank you both.
Yeah. Well, many thanks to our expert guests, Molly McMahon-Graziano, Director of Outreach for Ohio End of Life Options, and Kathleen Carmody, owner of Senior Matters Home Health Care and Consulting, a certified death doula and certified dementia practitioner. Both of them for joining us today. Listener, thank you for joining us. You're going to find the contact information and resources we discussed in the podcast in our show notes and on the website at lookingforwardourway.com. And we are looking forward to hearing your feedback on this or any of our other podcast episodes.
The views and opinions expressed by the experts interviewed on this podcast are their own and don't necessarily reflect the views of the podcast hosts or any affiliated organizations. The information provided in these interviews is for general informational purposes only and should not be considered as professional advice. Listeners are encouraged to consult with qualified professionals for specific advice or information related to their individual circumstances. The podcast host and producers don't endorse or guarantee the accuracy, completeness, or reliability of any information provided by the experts interviewed. Listener discretion is advised.